And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman on this Tuesday afternoon. Well, most everyone is determined to avoid adversity. Who needs more trouble in a difficult world? But of course, life's problems and travails make us stronger. With us now is Georgetown University clinical psychiatrist and researcher Dr. Norman Rosenthal. He's the author of The Gift of Adversity, The Unexpected Benefits of Life's Difficulties, Setbacks, and Imperfections. And Dr. Norman Rosenthal joins us from Rockville, Maryland. Welcome to you, Doctor.
Thank you.
Could you speak up a little bit?
How does that sound?
There we go. That's
okay,
better.
Terrific.
Hi, welcome, Doctor. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Your book isn't about why bad things happen to good people. It's about why adversity, which comes to all of us, is a gift and our best teacher. So why is that?
You know, I think we're programmed that way over the course of millions of years of evolution, that if things go wrong, we try and learn from that so that we don't do it again. And also, I think as human beings have gotten cleverer and cleverer, we try and codify. In other words, we try and learn from other people's mistakes as well, so that we don't have to go through every trauma ourselves. And actually, that's part of what the book's all about, is to say, look, here's a whole bunch of things that have gone wrong to me, to people I've known. These are some of the ways we've all dealt with it. This is how we've all grown from it. And maybe that'll be of some value to you as well.
Doctor, years ago you were brutally stabbed by criminals while in an automobile. What did you come away with besides emergency surgery?
Well, that was actually one of the most valuable lessons of my life, because there's nothing that teaches you the value and preciousness of life more strongly than having it almost snatched out from under you. And that's what happened. I almost died, but I didn't. I recovered fully. And when I did, I felt a sense of being alive more powerfully than I have ever done before or since. But a piece of that feeling has stayed with me, so that I feel like every day is an opportunity. Every day is a gift. We have to not only use it wisely, but also enjoy it. I mean, life is meant to be spent and enjoyed.
But we shouldn't have to have a near-death experience to learn that.
No, I'm saying, you know, hey, borrow my near-death experience.
Right.
Have this one on me, so to speak, because you don't have to be stabbed in order to realize that every day is a gift, because you just have to open the newspaper and realize. You know, I'll have patients I've seen for years, and then one day they come into my office and they say, you know, I've had some terrible diagnosis made, or my husband just dropped dead of a heart attack. And you really understand, as we all do when we grow older and we see things that happen, that life is actually, it's a paradox, because on the one hand, it feels very solid and we feel very secure. And on the other hand, we realize that it can be snuffed out in a moment.
If you've had an adverse situation in your life or a circumstance that's taught you a lesson or given you a gift, and you want to join in the conversation with Dr. Norman Rosenthal, please call us at 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-9576. And email is radio@wlrn.org.
Doctor, you say that adversity positively affects creativity. How does that work?
Well, you know, there's the old expression that necessity is the mother of invention.
Right.
When you get blocked somehow, it is part of the human spirit to find a way around a block. So I give the example in my book of Chuck Yeager, the astronaut. Before he was an astronaut, he was a test pilot.
Quite a wild man, too.
He was a wild man, yes, yes. And it probably it took a wild man to do what he did because he was the first man to break the sound barrier. And up until that time, when pilots had pushed the joystick in one direction and the plane went faster and faster, it would vibrate violently as though it was about to explode. So they would instinctively pull back and slow down so they wouldn't go through the sound barrier. But then Jaeger stepped up and was going to do this flight, and 2 days before the flight, he had a horse riding accident. You know, if he hadn't been a daredevil, he shouldn't have been riding the horse, and I think it was at night as well. And he broke a couple of ribs, and a friend had to basically help him into the cockpit of the plane, had to kind of rig up some kind of stick to close the door behind him. And there he went, approaching the sound barrier. The plane was shaking violently, but instead of pulling back on the joystick, he pushed forward. And that broke the sound barrier, and the rest of the flight was smooth. And that's just one of many, many examples of people who, in the presence of difficulty or an obstacle, pull out some creative workaround or some solution. And that's how so many creative discoveries have actually been made.
Is that evolutionary?
It is. It is because, you know, we learn. I mean, we are all hungry, so we eat little things from trees, and some of us drop dead. And then the others watch that and say, I'm going to eat from that tree. But the others don't drop dead. They flourish and say, I'm going to eat from that tree. So we kind of learn from example, and we learn from experience. And I don't recommend that people go and court adversity, but I do recommend that we use it wherever possible. As I like to say, don't waste a mistake. It's an opportunity to learn.
Well, as Joe said, most of us try to avoid it, and some even ignore it or deny that it exists when it can be detrimental. I guess, are you saying we should rethink adversity? Maybe we should embrace it, certainly not deny it?
Yes, denial is very costly. Because if you deny adversity, you can't even begin to deal with it. You're not accepting. For example, take a loss. Denying a loss, which is very common. You know, we have Joan Didion in her Year of Magical Thinking when mm-hmm. her husband died, looking at his shoes in the closet and thinking she can't throw them out because maybe he'll come back and want to wear them again.
Right.
And until you really say to yourself, he's gone, she's gone, they're gone, they're not coming back. It's a very painful statement to make, which is why you can see denial is appealing. But until you can say that, you can't really begin the healing process in full.
You know, you suggest that we take our time, analyze the situation, avoid overreacting or underreacting. But how do we respond appropriately when we're in this weakened or affected emotional state? Say you do just learn that you have a serious illness. Most people are in such a state of fear and anxiety that it's difficult to respond or analyze appropriately what's going on.
Well, I think we reach out for help. We reach out to loved ones who are in our corner and experts who really understand it better than we do. And then we start gathering information and dealing with it. This happens, for example, when someone is diagnosed with cancer. They begin to understand what are their options, what are the best approaches, what's going to help, what's not going to help. And so we begin to analyze. That's if you're lucky enough to have the time, which is usually the case. Usually we have the time. Sometimes you don't. When I was stabbed, I was just under attack, and I started to honk the horn, and I grabbed the assailant's hand, and I ground it against the broken glass of the window. I mean, these were instinctive things. I didn't think for long, and fortunately, the lights went on all around, and they ran away. They were scared. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here having this lovely conversation with you all.
And certainly, the case of your mom, I don't know how she thought so quickly as she did when she did when she was under attack.
That to me is, you know, I'm just sort of, she's passed now, but I'm so proud of her when I think because the story there is that the 75-year-old woman is lying asleep in her cottage, which was in the garden of my sister's home, and she's woken up like 2 or 3 in the morning with three young thugs on top of her. And imagine the fear, the terror. They're pulling her ring off her finger, they're choking her, they're pressing down upon her, and in an instant she understands they want money and they want anonymity. And she whispers to them, if you get off me, I'll show you where the money is and I'll show you out without turning the lights on. And to me, the miracle is that in the middle of the night, three young thugs listened to the words of an old woman. And when the police arrived, they said, you know, there's nothing unusual about this crime in Johannesburg except for one thing, the victim is alive. Mm. And so to me that, you know, she was my hero. And one aspect of that is that it made me realize that sometimes being a hero is just staying alive so you can be there for your loved ones.
We're speaking with Dr. Norman Rosenthal. He's an author and a clinical professor of psychiatry at Georgetown Medical School. And his latest book is The Gift of Adversity. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back. Again, you can call us at 1-800-743-9576.
And we return 20 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman and Dr. Norman Rosenthal. Again, our telephone number if you'd like to call in. Perhaps there's been a meaningful gift in your life given to you by adversity. That's 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, Bonnie will take your email. That's radio at WLRN.org. Doctor, before we take calls, how does your take along with this book go, say, with the philosophy of Nietzsche and that power emanates from adversity and friction?
I agree. I agree very much. And in fact, he also said what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Mm-hmm. And I think that is very much to the point here. Shakespeare also said, sweet are the uses of adversity. And then he compared adversity to a venomous toad, which nevertheless has a jewel in its head, you know, the gift that comes with the ugly animal. So I think that philosophers, writers have understood. And really, though, when I set about writing the series of stories, because the book consists of 52 short stories, everyone is self-contained, and I hope that the readers find them funny, poignant, strange, interesting. But everyone has a little take-home at the end of what I got out of that story and what perhaps the reader might enjoy hearing about or find useful or interesting. So, you know, before I actually wrote a lot of the stories, I didn't realize the unifying theme, and that was that it's when things go wrong. Setbacks, disappointments, imperfections, that's when we learn the most.
I'd like to talk about the imperfections a little, because usually when we do think of adversity, we think of death, loss, terrible illness, but you do include our imperfections and dealing with imperfections and shortcomings. Explain that.
Yes, I think that here in the States, there is quite an obsession with presenting a perfect facade. This kind of takes its most extreme form in that annual Christmas letter, which is not as popular as it once was. But that letter was always full of nothing but good news. You know, Dad's business is thriving, Mom is enjoying walking around the new estate, and the Labradors are running around happy, and Johnny's at Harvard, and Jeannie's at Swarthmore, and everybody's great. And the reality may be that Dad's business may be on the skids. Mom may just have come out of rehab. Johnny is walking around stoned. Jeannie's failing her courses. I mean, maybe not. But if that were the case, nobody would want to. It's like we've got to put our best face forward all the time, and that is a very big stress on us because we are not perfect, none of us.
You say in the States, you think this is peculiar to the United States and this?
You know, I think everybody likes to appear well and well put together. But I think that we have an extreme here because we have this inbuilt sense of marketing ourselves and publicizing ourselves. And it's like part of the culture to really, I mean, we are the PR packaging experts of the world. And I think that it, you know, communicates itself in our daily lives.
Let's take a phone call or two. We've got some lines open. Fanny in Coral Springs, nice old-fashioned name. Fanny, how are you?
I'm okay, thank you. Thank you so much for taking my call. I just think this topic is so fascinating because just because I've been thinking about this the last year, I've had a lot of losses. Some, you know, the worst thing that can happen to me.
Fanny? I think we've lost her.
Hello, can you hear me?
There we go.
Now we can.
I'm sorry. So I was saying I have a lot of losses in this past year. So it made me kind of reconsider what really happiness is. And it's not about things. It's just about not overreacting, about just accepting life, but kind of like do something about it, but don't make a big deal out of it either.
Losses. Losses are very sad for everybody, and of course, every loss is different, and for every person it's different. In the last part of my book, I have a section called Farewells, where we say goodbye to all the characters or many of the characters that we've met in the course of the book. And one of my friends who edited the book for me informally said, oh, but that's really sad, you know, can't you sort of make a happy ending so the whole thing ends on an upbeat note. So I tried to create a sort of happy epilogue, a happy ending, but you know, it just felt fake. It isn't really true because that is part of life. And you said it very, very well, Fanny. That is part of life, and accepting it is part of getting on with life and part of healing. So I'm sorry about the losses, but I really think that your attitude will carry you through.
Okay, Fanny.
Yeah, I know. I was going to add just one thing. Something that they kind of bothers me about some people is that they feel sorry for you. Like, oh, my God, I'm so sorry that you're feeling bad for you, but not in a good way. And I just think, like, when I have somebody, like, I have some losses lately and the way I express my sorry for them is just be there for them, but not make them feel like patronize them. Don't make them feel like because you lost it, I'm better than you. You know what I'm saying? It's just when you say to somebody that you're sorry, sometimes just being there for that person is the best thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're right, and I think that you are in a position to influence how they behave towards you. And so if they say, I'm really sorry, you might say, you know what would really help is if we could go have coffee together. And so sometimes people don't always know the best way to express their sympathy. And maybe that's something you can actually help them with and help yourself at the same time.
Hope that helps. Thanks so much for calling, Fanny. We have an emailer. Anne says, I can relate very much to your guest concept as a 21-year-plus cancer survivor. 21-year-plus cancer survivor. I founded a nonprofit, Annie Appleseed Project, providing folks in part with simple lifestyle changes. Of course, this included enjoying life every day.
And well, I think that's wise. You know, when you've, as I said, with my own experience, when you've almost had life snatched away, you really learn that every day is not to be taken for granted.
In these economic times, loss of jobs certainly weighs on people quite heavily with adversity. How do you keep your spirits up when that happens? And tell us about how you were forced out of the National Institutes of Health.
Yes, that's an interesting story because it's interesting because it's so commonplace that so many people are forced out of jobs for one reason or another. And oftentimes the job can't say, listen, you know, you cost too much money. We want to use your position for something else. We haven't really got a good reason, but you're out anyway. They don't want to expose themselves to lawsuits. They want to appear as though they're, you know, handling everything on the up and up. And so what often happens in the process is that they make you feel badly, or they don't make you feel badly, but they say, look, your work isn't up to snuff. Now, what happened with me and my colleague is we've done some real groundbreaking work there, and, you know, we've continued to be creative since leaving there. But there was a new management, and they thought, well, these guys should go. And so even though we had tenure, you know, it's easy to make things uncomfortable for people, and if people have a sense of self-respect and they have options, they probably aren't going to stick around if you put them into tiny little offices and take away their staff and their resources. And that's basically what happened to me. And to me, the most important thing is Eleanor Roosevelt said, no one can make you feel inferior without your consent. And that is beautifully put because, you know, people can say, look, you're not good enough to be here, but you have to buy that in order to really feel badly about that. And I didn't buy that. I moved along. I developed my own research organization. We did some very interesting stuff. I wrote books. I saw my patients. I've really had a great time since leaving the NIH. And the reason I wanted to communicate that to people is so many people are out there feeling so hurt, even ashamed or embarrassed that they've been laid off, to understand that it's not necessarily got anything to do with you, not to take it personally, but just to realize that these are the times we're living in. Jobs are not as steady as they once were. And so it's very important to understand what your skills are and recognize that you have acquired a lot of resources and internal assets and then use them going forward.
It's great advice. We do have an emailer whose name would rather not be mentioned. I spent years in hospitals as a kid with a bone disease. I'll never forget an older nurse late one awful night telling me that in her experience, children who suffered long-term physical problems grew up to be either the very strongest or the very weakest of adults, and that the key to this was to focus not on what happens, but on how we react to it, because our reaction is the only thing that's within our control. One thing I did, probably all people do after misfortune, is ask myself, why me? She said, the answer to that is simple. Why not you? Are you special? Realizing I could not control events, but could only control my own behavior and reactions made all the difference.
Well, I think that's just brilliant. I think that nurse was really brilliant. You know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Either you're going to be pushed down by it or you're going to be strengthened by it. So make a choice here. And one of my great heroes, whom I have a chapter on in the book, is the Holocaust survivor Viktor Frankl, who was a neurologist and a wonderful author. He wrote the brilliant book Man's Search for Meaning that sold more than 10 million copies. And he said, the last of human freedoms to be taken away from you, when every other human freedom has been taken away from you, the last remaining one is the freedom to choose how you're going to see your circumstances. And that's what this lady is saying, that, you know, the freedom to choose. Are you going to see yourself as a down-and-out victim, or are you going to see yourself as a survivor? What I discovered really after writing the book is that, you know, we all have heard of post-traumatic stress disorder. What is less well known is that there is a whole literature on post-traumatic growth. The fact that many people, even who've suffered terrible things like cancer of the mouth, which required reconstructive surgery, or breast cancer, they have, after the cancer, cancer is dealt with, acquired in many instances belief systems or a sense of meaning that they hadn't had before. So there is almost like it's as though the personality actually grows and develops as a result of the adversity.
We're speaking with Dr. Norman Rosenthal. We're talking about his book, The Gift of Adversity. We're going to take a short break and be back with more.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Dr. Norman Rosenthal. His latest book, I just want to say he was the first psychiatrist to describe and diagnose seasonal affective disorder, among other things, and his latest book is The Gift of Adversity, The Unexpected Benefits of Life's Difficulties, Setbacks, and Imperfections.
Seasonal adversity. I'm not sure what that is, but I hope I don't have it.
Seasonal affected disorder.
Disorder.
Yes.
Well, you're lucky because in Florida you get much less of it than we get. I'm looking out of the window right now, and it is gray and dreary over here. And that's what happened when my family and I first came to New York. We were hit by this dark, grim weather.
You're from South Africa.
Yes, I was from sunny South Africa. And I didn't know what hit me because I felt slowed down in the wintertime, lacking energy, lacking enthusiasm. And the condition of seasonal affective disorder had not yet been described. But I was involved in describing that and developing a therapy involving extra light. So my biggest adversity also turned out to be my biggest gift because I was able to do that because of my own experiences.
We have calls, but just in listening to you, I'm thinking, how important was your upbringing in your ability to turn around adversity? It sounds like your mother was quite an example and was very resourceful. But don't you think that affects one's ability to do these kind of things, to turn adversity into creativity or to our benefit?
It does. It does. She had that kind of indomitable spirit, you know. If you had an aspirin, if you'd had a headache, she'd say, take an aspirin. If you had some other pain, she'd say it'll be better tomorrow. You know, gave you a sense that whatever it was going to get better. You just had to do the right thing, you know?
Right.
And I think it did give a person a lot of confidence, actually.
Let's take a couple of phone calls. This is Warren in Del Rey. Hi.
Very gracious of you to take my call. Dr. Rosenthal, wonderful topic. My math teacher in seventh grade taught me the most valuable lesson I think I ever learned in school, and it was a quote from Nietzsche that she wrote in my autograph book. It said, in the mountains of truth, you never climb in vain. Either you stop at a particular point today, or you exercise your energies to climb to greater heights tomorrow. So that I guess Nietzsche was using the mountain as a metaphor for adversity. And I've found on various occasions in my life that strengthen my determination when I got my second wind came up. My efforts perhaps as an artist or a writer were redoubled. But I got another wonderful piece of information from my very special friend, the late artist and writer Jack Kirby, who was the co-creator of Captain America, the Hulk, the Fantastic Four, Thor, the X-Men, and others. And he said to me at the conclusion of a very special chat we had, he said, try to set a good example for others. So, I mean, who's going to do his best if he's going to get stepped on? Years ago, we all helped each other. And I find that also to be true because I'm a writer, I'm an artist, and so forth. And you need positive reinforcement. It is good to get constructive criticism, but if all you get is adversity, and the field has become much more adverse in the last few years, it has a detrimental effect on creativity and productivity. At least I find it so.
Dr. Rosenthal, would you like to comment?
Yes, I completely agree. You know, my friend David Lynch, who's a filmmaker and an artist, talks about this, and he says, you know, there's this romantic French idea of somebody suffering in a garret for the sake of his art. He says, nobody did art from suffering in a garret. You know, he says, if you were up in the garret sick and with diarrhea, and you wouldn't have been able to create. You need to have a sense of balance and equilibrium. But I think that what I'm really saying is sort of scattered throughout your life, these bad things can become a focus of creativity and development and growth. I think it's fascinating, incidentally, that your math teacher, what you learn from your math teacher is not the quadratic equation, but what the math teacher told you that Nietzsche had said. And I think that this is a fascinating quality of learning. I put in my book that, you know, somebody said life's what happens when you're busy making plans. And I would always learn when I was supposed to be learning something else. So one of the best lessons I ever learned was from a substitute teacher who misspelled the word ruler. Instead of R-U-L-E-R, she spelled it R-U-L-A-R. And when I came home and I told my parents, they kind of laughed and laughed. And I said, it's impossible that she's wrong. She's a teacher. And then they laughed even more that I would be so naive to think that a teacher was always right. And that was like one of the most liberating experiences for me, because what it really taught me is that authorities can be wrong. Any authority, the teacher, the rabbi, the priest, the prime minister, it was very liberating to feel that these guys can all be absolutely wrong. And I started having fun spotting where everybody was wrong.
You know, that's interesting that you're talking about these authority figures being wrong and that everyone can be wrong, because you are one. Being a psychiatrist and a doctor, many people see you as an authority figure. And your take on that, I find this really pretty fascinating, Doctor, that you say, as a psychiatrist, you are most sensitive and in touch with your patient's problems when experiencing your own difficulties. And doesn't that run contrary to how we think of the practice of psychiatry, though?
Well, you know, I think that historically we have thought of the psychiatrist as this kind of on a pedestal character about whom we know absolutely nothing.
Right.
And I've really put it out there that, look, I'm a human being. I got stabbed, which was my fault because I shouldn't have been parked there. I got into a scam, which was my fault because I didn't get proper counsel and guidance. I was, you're really silly about that. I've made some real mistakes, and you know, I've tried to learn from them and become a little better. I'm way short of perfect, God knows. But in any event, I was fascinated at how my patients would feel, because they all ran out and got the book, of course. And I thought, what are they going to think? And what are my colleagues going to think?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have not had a single negative word from anybody. My patients have all been delighted. Everybody has thought it was interesting. And I think maybe the climate is changing where it's okay to be human. I think that would be great if that's true.
Especially,
tell us more about that Ponzi scheme business.
Oh, yes. It was, without getting into the details of it, I thought that this thing would offer me a fixed return. And that's a big, big red flag whenever something's going to offer you a fixed return, because, you know, interest rates are going to fluctuate up and down. So whoever is offering you a fixed return, if interest rates would fall, they would be stuck with a huge debt to service. So it's highly unlikely that such a thing is going to be legitimate or viable. But I didn't know that at the time. It seemed like a good idea at the time. As they say, it was one of the worst ideas. But luckily, I did succeed in getting all the money back, but it was not well done. It was not something. But one of the most interesting things that happened was when I went to my accountant to explain to him a situation, he told me that he had collected gold coins through a certain coin expert that he'd worked with for years and years and years. And then the coin collector called him one day and said, you know, I have got a buyer who will buy all your gold coins at a premium price, but I need to have them delivered to me this afternoon. Well, it was such a good opportunity that my accountant brought all the gold coins over, and the coins and the collector were never seen again.
Oh.
He made off with the coins. But the fact is, I knew my accountant was a very clever man.
Mm-hmm.
It was very kind of him to share that story with me. It actually made me feel better, made me realize that making mistakes or being greedy or being silly was part of the human condition.
We're speaking with Dr. Norman Rosenthal and his latest book. He is a professor of clinical psychiatry at Georgetown Medical School. And his latest book is The Gift of Adversity. One more short break and we'll come back and take more calls.
And we return. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Our topic today is adversity with Dr. Norman Rosenthal. His book is called The Gift of Adversity. Let's go to calls. We've got Steve. He's in Pompano Beach. Thanks for your patience. Hi.
Oh, thank you so much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a comment, and then I have a question for Dr. Rosenthal. First, in learning about how to handle my own adversity and realizing that what I put my attention upon, I become. And so in feeding my resistance to whatever I perceive is bad or wrong, it does keep me stuck in that negative place. And I've developed a mantra that I use, and it is, if I love what I have currently, then I will always have what I love. And that in itself does help me to break through the resistance to whatever's going on into acceptance. So that's my comment. I also have a question about how fear and excitement might have the similar body sensation to each other, that actually the experience of feeling the body sensation of fear is very similar to that of excitement. The only difference between fear and excitement then would be my thought, what I believe it's, I'm either in fear or it's something exciting for me.
Well, a couple of thoughts. Firstly, in terms of your mantra that you've discovered is really helpful. It reminds me a little bit of that song, if you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with.
Stephen Stills.
Yeah. It's true.
Yeah, so it reminds me a little bit of that. But it's the point is, whatever one's mantra is, if it works, there's no arguing with it. You found a little strategy that works for you. And I love it when the people I treat find these little strategies because it's so creative and it's so helpful. So I'll say, you know, go with it. In terms of different states of arousal or excitement having certain similar physiological underpinnings, that is a very old classical theory initially put forward by William James and then taken up by Lange. It was called the James-Lange hypothesis that depending on the context, the state of arousal, increased adrenaline, increased norepinephrine in the brain, increased excitatory responses will be interpreted differently based on the state of arousal. So that is a very well-established theory. Some people have argued for and against, but it's kind of come back into vogue as the body is thought to be a very important component in our emotional responses.
Doctor, we only have about 5 minutes left. I'd like to spend some of that time looking at your fundamental rules for overcoming adversity. One of them, which I have a question about, is you say develop good habits. And you say that self-control doesn't stand the test of time, but good habits do. But doesn't it require self-control to develop good habits?
You know, it does. But let's say, you know, do what you can to do it little bit by little bit. Let's say that you want to lose weight. So you say, okay, I'll take sugar out of my diet. I can do that. I can still have bread. I can still have potatoes, but I'll take sugar out. And then after a while, you say, you know, I'm not missing the sugar. Maybe I can take bread out as well. And so little bit by little bit, you're developing good eating habits that don't take that much self-control because you get used to them. That's the amazing thing. When you get used to something, it becomes easier. And I give the example of how a lot of us would fight with our parents about brushing our teeth. You know, we didn't want to brush our teeth. We don't want to wash our face, whatever it was, you know, they wanted us to do. And, you know, but now, I mean, most of us would not want to go to bed without brushing our teeth or washing our face. We just kind of wouldn't feel, we'd feel icky. And so I think that's what the habit does. The habit makes it feel comfortable to do what's good for you simply through repetition.
So I see. So you're saying it's not that you don't exert any self-control. It's just not you're supposed to be white-knuckling it.
Exactly. You don't say, look, take out bread, rice, sugar, potato, or candy and ice cream, by the way, and pies. I mean, somebody will laugh at you if you think that they're going to do all that. But bit by bit, it's amazing how much can be done without actually struggling. And then there are habits that help you do other things more regularly. Like I say, meditation, transcendental meditation, has helped me with all of my good habits. And speaking of good habits, I've developed the habit of putting out my website. And I just don't want to miss that. It's normanrosenthal.com. And I just want to be sure that people know that, because if they want to come and check out what I've written or come visit me or see what I have to say, please feel free just to stop by and pay me a visit.
Okay.
And we'll take a quick call. It'll have to be a very quick call. Lucas in Miami. Hi there. I'm short on time.
Hi there. Thank you for the call. Why, if two brothers grow up in an adverse environment, they have different outcomes? One is a really successful guy, and the other one is not.
You know, there's obviously the genetics have a huge role. If, let's say, or it depends on what happens. It depends on the genetics. Let's say the one kid was very sick when they were an infant, and they had something wrong with them or something. Or it could be a difference in parenting. Let's say the first child gets a lot of the mother's attention, and then she goes into a depression when the second child is born and she hardly touches him. So there's so many things that have such a key formative influence that it is amazing to see, but it isn't surprising because it happens all the time.
Well, we have just about a minute left, Doctor. You brought up Viktor Frankl already, but you did get a chance to meet him. And I wondered what that was like for you. What did you learn from actually meeting him?
Well, the first thing was just the experience of being with a great man. And it wasn't just that he was great because I'd read his stuff. It was that he had such a presence about him, such an openness, such a willingness to engage on all these traumatic subjects. He didn't put any preconditions to the interview.
Mm.
He spoke about everything, the death of his parents in the camps, the death of his wife, coming out starving. And then the fact that he could find it within himself to be reconciled to those people who had injured him and be actually very forgiving and, you know, find ways to take that experience and turn it into something useful. He embodied the gift of adversity.
We have
so
to go.
He's a good person to end our talk on.
Yes, I thought so. Well, thank you, Dr. Norman Rosenthal. Your website is normanrosenthal.com.
Exactly.
And we'll have links to the book, The Gift of Adversity, The Unexpected Benefits of Life's Difficulties, Setbacks, and Imperfections on our website. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
You Bye. Too.
And thanks for listening. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction by Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads of this and previous programs at our website, wlrn.org. More information as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow at 1, it's live coverage of the Miami-Dade School Board meeting. Thursday, we consider the beneficial side of adversity. Also, Linda Gassenheimer discusses the links between diet and cancer. And to the calendar, on this day in 1954, 59 years ago, just retired baseball star Joe DiMaggio marries Hollywood's Marilyn Monroe at San Francisco City Hall. It lasted 9 months. DiMaggio carried the torch for the rest of his life. And on this day in 1968, 46 years ago, the NFL's Green Bay Packers beat the AFL's Oakland Raiders 33-14 at the Orange Bowl in what would the next year be named the Super Bowl. Bart Starr was MVP. TV coverage was blacked out in the Miami area. The average price of a ticket for the Super Bowl, or what would become the Super Bowl, $8. One more while we turn the pages of Delta of Venus and House of Incest. On this day in 1977, 37 years ago, the death of writer Anais Nin. Though born in France, her parents were Cuban. She was 73 and romantically linked with writer Henry Miller, the first husband, of course, of Marilyn Monroe. It all ties together. So we leave with a quote from Nin, best known for her journals. Quote, "Love never dies a natural death. It dies because we don't know how to replenish its source." Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, stay with us for Here and Now from NPR News.